If you would turn, please, to Job chapter 32. Job 32. When you ask people what the book of Job is about, I would suspect, I've never tested this scientifically, but about 99 out of 100 would say, duh, suffering. And that's true, but it's a little bit, I think, of a misconception. As we discovered in Sunday school, all the way through the book of Job, the discussion and the debate between Job and his friends focuses not so much on suffering or even specifically Job's suffering, but on God's character and God's actions. What he's like, what he does, what he doesn't do, how we gauge our relationship to him, his pleasure with us or his displeasure with us. And chapters 27 to 31, as I mentioned this morning, contain Job's final self-defense. After the others don't have anything left to argue, he's answered their arguments. They really haven't answered his. His final defense of his righteousness in every area of life. And he concludes that with a final plea for God to answer him. And I asked you to turn to Job 32, but if you'd actually look just a little bit above that, the last verses of chapter 31, beginning in verse 35. Job says, "Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my mark. Oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book." That term prosecutor, at least here in the New King James, is literally the man of my dispute, my legal opponent. And he's referring, of course, to God. The Almighty and the prosecutor are the same person. "Surely I would carry it on my shoulder and bind it on me like a crown. I would declare to him," God, "the number of my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him." Now, what I'm about to say, you have to take in the context of everything that we looked at this morning in the Sunday School Hour about the book as a whole and about Job's development through that book as a whole. But there is a kind of swagger to these last words of Job. He has silenced his friends. He is confident that he's entirely in the right. The implication, without stating it, is that any failure, mistake, oversight isn't on his side. It's basically almost as far as he will go. And he would approach God as a prince wrongfully treated and give a full account of all his ways before God. The friends have fallen silent because they don't know what else to say. They can't believe Job, but they can't answer him either. That brings us then to chapter 32. So these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel the Buzite of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. His wrath was aroused because he justified himself rather than God. This is the narrator's explanation. His wrath was aroused because Job justified himself rather than God. Also against the three friends, his wrath was aroused because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. Now, because they were years older than he, Elihu had waited to speak to Job. When Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, his wrath was aroused. So a new speaker shows up on the scene in chapters 32 through 37. By the way, did you notice a phrase that pops up four times through that narrator's introduction of this man? His wrath was aroused four times. Only one other person is that said of in the book. Only one other person in the book is described as his wrath being aroused. I won't tell you who, but I'll give you the reference. You can look it up for yourself. Chapter 42, verse 7. Job's friends had insisted that Job was suffering because of sin. Again, we know from the prologue that's incorrect. Elihu changes the charge against Job. He does not argue that Job is suffering because of sin. He argues that Job is sinning because of his suffering. And I want to show you just four specific passages in chapters, in Elihu's chapters, before we move into God's final answer, because they're going to factor into, I would argue, God's final answer. Four specific passages in Elihu's speech. He charges Job first with fighting against God, contending with God. Chapter 33, verse 13, he says, "Why do you contend with him?" That word is going to show up again. That argument in that specific language. Secondly, he charges Job with making God look unjust, effectively condemning him without saying that in so many words. Chapter 34, verse 17, he says, "Will you condemn him that is most just?" And again, you're tempted to think, well, now, wait a minute. Job never actually condemned God. But God is going to come back and use exactly those same words when he confronts Job. "Will you condemn him that is most just?" And then thirdly, he charges Job with speaking with a confidence that is matched only by his ignorance. Chapter 34, verse 35, "Job has spoken without knowledge, and his words are without wisdom." And again, chapter 35, verse 16, Job multiplies words without knowledge. Those words are going to show up again. So is Elihu right? Well, I think we'll see. The last word on this whole discussion comes in the chapters that we are considering this morning. That's chapters 38 through 41. And the Lord divides his speech into two movements. And I want to show you exactly where the division is so that it just breaks apart for you. Chapter 38, verses 1 through 3, "The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Prepare yourself like a man, for I will question you and you will answer me.'" Turn over a page or two to chapter 40, verses 6 to 7. And you read these words. "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Prepare yourself like a man, for I will question you and you will answer me.'" That should sound familiar. That marks the two divisions of God's speech, God's monologue to Job, where he pauses at the beginning of chapter 40 for a reply from Job, and we'll look at that. But that breaks up the speech into two sections. And God's first speech, then, is what I would call an examination, chapters 38 and 39. And it begins with a summons in the first three verses that we just read. Again, Job has repeatedly been calling for God to answer him. He wants some explanation. He wants to hear something from God. He knows the friends aren't right. For example, he says in 13:22, "Call and I will answer, or let me speak and I will answer you," he says to God. 23:5, he said, "I would know the words that he," God, "would answer me." Chapter 30, verse 20, "I cry unto you, but you do not answer me." And again, 31:35 that we just read at the beginning, "Let the Almighty answer me." He wants an answer from God. And that's why every word in 38:1 is, I think, so relevant. Because the friends have had their chance to answer Job, but now it's God's turn. The Lord answered Job. And for the moment, God is concerned with no one else. The Lord is answering Job. He's not talking to the friends. He's not talking to Elihu. He's answering Job. But I think the most meaningful word is the verb. The Lord answered Job. God has been silent, but he has not been absent. And now he answers. And this is the definitive divine perspective on the last 37 chapters. Everything that's happened and everything that's been said about what's happened. And by way of introduction, God makes two points. And the first is this: when you are tempted to question God's ways, remember how little you know. In the first four verses of God's speech, verses 2 through 5 of chapter 38, he uses the word knowledge four times. It's kind of camouflaged by translational variety, but the Hebrew word knowledge is in every one of those verses. Verse 2, it's obvious. "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" By the way, do those words sound familiar? I hesitate to put it this way, but it's effectively God is quoting Elihu. It's exactly what Elihu said about Job. Verse 3, "Prepare yourself like a man," God says, "for I will question you and you will answer me." That's actually a Hebrew verb, to know, to make me know. I will question you and you will make me know. Same Hebrew term. Verse 4, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if you have understanding." Interestingly, the word "have" is actually a translation of the Hebrew verb to know, if you know understanding. And then verse 5, "Who determined its measurements? Surely you know." And again, if you glance down at chapter 38, verse 18, he injects the point very sharply into the interrogation. Chapter 38, verse 18, tell me if you know all this. And the point, of course, is that Job doesn't know nearly so much as he thought he knew about anything. And the Hebrew word for knowing appears 10 times total in God's first speech. The synonym understanding occurs another 6 times, so God is clearly directing Job to think about what he does and does not know. So that's his first point. His second point is, when you are tempted to question God's ways, focus on the right question. Job's chronic question all through the book has been, why? At least 20 times he asks, why? And it is our instinctive question in the midst of suffering, is it not? We want to know why this is happening, why God is doing this to me. But why is not a question that God usually answers. And it's not the question we really need answered. And what God does in this is shift the ground from Job's question of why to God raising his own question of who. Drop the question, table the question why for a while, Job. Let me ask you some questions about who. Who you are and who it is you are dealing with. So when God finally speaks, he does answer, but he does not explain. He doesn't answer that question, why? Never answers that question. He renders it irrelevant in the shadow of the bigger question of who. And, you know, why is an entirely legitimate question. We ask it, it's instinctive, as I say. It's not something that we should be embarrassed to ask or feel like we can't ask. But it can become an infected question. Because over time, Job's very innocent question of why would you do this to me, Lord, festers into a more accusatory complaint. How could you do this to me, Lord? And Job is never rebuked for asking why in God's response. He is rebuked for letting an honest question sour into implication, into insinuation, and into a very subtle form of accusation. So God's answer to Job's question, why, is the counter question of who. Who are you? In other words, are you really qualified to question my ways? And who am I? Do you realize just whom you have been challenging? One writer puts it this way. I love this statement about what's going on here. Job needs to learn that the issue here at stake with his suffering, the issue is not ethical, the question is not why, and the need is not understanding. The issue is spiritual. The question is who, and the need is trust. Because the bottom line question is who. It's a person. It's not about stuff that's happening. It's the person who's doing all of this. So with that, God's interrogation of Job begins in earnest. And the interrogation begins in chapter 38, verse 4, and it runs all the way through 39:30. And the first part is, don't know how you feel about this, physical science. Part A of the exam is physical science, 38:4 through 38:38. And I'm going to get a little technical here for a moment because God gets pretty technical with Job. Part one of Job's interrogation, God's interrogation of Job, is in the area of geophysics and astrophysics, which I don't know a whole lot about. I can pronounce the words, but that's about it. But in the process of these verses, if you just kind of look down through, say, just glance at verses 4 through 7 in chapter 38, the Lord questions Job's grasp of cosmology and geology. Verses 8 to 11, he questions Job about oceanography. Verses 12 to 15, and then several other sections through this chapter, meteorology, weather. Chapter 38, verses 16 to 18, suboceanic hydrology. How much do you know about that? 38, 19 to 21, spectroscopy. What is that? Light, the study of light, how light works. He questions Job about this. And 38, 31 to 33, astronomy. And God poses his questions in a variety of forms. He probes Job's antiquity. Were you there when? Or he will quiz Job's knowledge. Do you know? Or he'll ask Job about Job's experience. Have you ever done this? Or he tests Job's control. Can you do this? And then he shifts into life science, part B of the exam, chapter 38, 39 through 39, 30. Job's examination then turns to zoology, which I find a little more interesting personally. And the Lord takes Job on, the best way I know to describe this is kind of a verbal safari. But what God begins to do here is to weave another theme into this examination of Job. This isn't just about God pulling rank and making Job feel ignorant. He's accomplishing something else in the process, and it really begins to take form here. So he points out, chapter 38, verses 39 and 40, that God, not Job, supplies food for lions and for their cubs. Verse 41, God provides for the raven when, it's put poetically clearly, but when its young cry to God for food. Look at 39:1. God knows whenever wild mountain goats labor to give birth and whenever a deer calves, God knows about that. And it's not just a sterile, clinical, omniscient kind of knowledge. Look at verse 3. He takes note of the labor pains and the birthing process of animals. And verse 4, he delights in, this is 39:4, he delights in the healthy growth, their young ones are healthy, their maturity, they grow strong with grain, their independence, they depart and do not return to their parents. He describes all this with not just expressing his awareness, but his delight in these animals, these creatures. And you might think, honestly, what does this have to do with Job's problem? I mean, he's lost all of his children, he's lost everything, and you're talking to him about animals? How is this an answer to Job's question? And I think what God is beginning to do here is, in a sense, bear his heart to Job. Yes, the Lord is powerful and majestic and wise, but he is also deeply aware and compassionate, even toward beasts. Do you think he's not intimately aware of your circumstances and compassionate to you in your need? If he cares this much about and knows this much about animals, you are the only creature that he fashioned in his own image. Ravens aren't, deer aren't, mountain goats aren't. You are. You are the only creature qualified to be called a child of God. He doesn't even talk that way about his angels. You are infinitely more valuable to God than lions or ravens or goats or deer or, let me throw in another one, sparrows. Jesus talked about this to his disciples, did he not? Matthew 10, 29 to 31. He told his disciples, "You are of more value than many sparrows." I think Jesus had a much more a subtle and a keen and a very lively sense of humor that we miss. Because that's a very humorous statement. You are of more value than many sparrows. How many sparrows do you think you are worth to God? 10? Think you're worth 100 sparrows? Do you think God would give 1,000 sparrows for you? How many sparrows are you worth? It's absurd. Because God didn't suffer and die for sparrows. He suffered and died for you. That's how much more he cares about us. Didn't even suffer and die for angels. But he suffered and died for you. And God is emphasizing here not only his wisdom and his knowledge and his power, he's covering those bases in the process, but he's also now bringing in his goodness and his kindness and his compassion and his awareness. which is something we question, don't we, when we are suffering, for an extended period of time particularly. He really wants us to know and remember this about Him, especially when we're suffering and hurting under affliction, that He is, in the fullest sense of these terms, He is a sympathetic sovereign. And the exam goes on as the Lord draws attention to Job's impotence and ignorance when it comes to a whole series of wild creatures through the rest of chapter 39. Now look at chapter 40, verse 1. God is going to sum up His case so far and states His indictment in the form of a question. This is the indictment. The end of this first speech, He issues an indictment. Verses 1 through 5 of chapter 40. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, "Shall the one who contends..." Does that word sound familiar? "Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it." He's talking to Job. And God's own interpretation of what Job has come to do in his response to his suffering is effectively accuse God of malfeasance. "You're going to contend, you're going to argue, you're going to fight with me? Let the one who wants to correct me or rebuke me, let him answer it." But if Job doesn't even understand all the things that he can see, all the stuff that God has been questioning him about, all these verses and all these interrogation questions, that's all stuff he can see. He can see the light, he can see the ocean, he can see, you know, all these things in creation. If he can't even understand the stuff that he can see, how can he possibly presume to explain the things he can't see? And after the indictment, Job enters his initial plea, verses 3 through 5. And he basically pleads a kind of temporary insanity. He says, verse 4, "Behold, I am vile." The word literally means, "I'm nothing. What shall I answer you? I will lay my hand upon my mouth." And when you've been talking too much about stuff you don't really know about, shutting up is a good start. But it's just a start. Because there are some things God means to hear Job say, that Job needs to be able to say. So the Lord is not quite finished yet. And so he begins his second speech. The first was an examination. This is an exhibition. And it starts in chapter 40, verse 6, and runs through the end of chapter 41. God repeats the same challenge that he started with. Verse 6, "The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Prepare yourself like a man. I will question you and you will answer me.'" This is what you wanted, Job. You wanted to question me and let me answer you, or you said, I'll question you and you answer me. This is exactly what you wanted. And the second speech then, the exhibition, actually begins with a restatement of the indictment. Look at verse 8. Look at the words that he uses here. "Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me?" Does that sound familiar? It's exactly what Elihu said Job had been doing. God's perspective now is the same. "Will you condemn me so that you will be justified?" And again, Job in effect impugned God's righteousness. That's God's interpretation of what Job had been saying. Job was great at defending his own righteousness. God's, not so much. Couldn't speak for God, really. He could speak for himself. But he couldn't speak for God because, as we talked about earlier, what he started by doing was looking at his circumstances through the lens of what he knew to be true about God. That's the biblical perspective. What he came to do with time, and time suffering tends to make this happen, is reverse those. And he began looking at God through the lens of his circumstances. And all of a sudden, God didn't seem to be quite so just and quite so fair and quite so righteous. So what are the implications of some of the things that we say or think about God when we are enduring affliction, adversity, difficulty, extended especially? Or what are the implications of some of the things that we don't say about Him? Might God see that as contending with the Almighty, rebuking Him, condemning Him in order to justify ourselves? And by the way, if you haven't figured it out yet, Elihu was exactly right in his diagnosis of Job. And God even uses Elihu's words to prove it. After that second indictment and his second speech, this is exhibition again, he moves then to the illustration, or illustrations. There are two of them, actually. And this begins in chapter 40, verse 9. The first speech, I think you can sum up with the words, "Answer this, Job." But the second one is, "Look at this, Job. I want to show you some stuff. Let's talk about this." Chapter 38 to 39 was a creation-wide panorama of God's power and sovereignty. In chapters 40 and 41, God zooms in on some, really two, very specific aspects of that creation. In fact, just two creatures. And the terms for them are Behemoth and Leviathan. So, the question on everybody's mind is, what are these things? What is Behemoth? What is Leviathan? Everybody wants to know. Lots of suggestions have been offered. I have my own opinion as to what they are, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. And the reason I'm not going to is because that's the least important question in this whole passage. And it is possible to become so distracted by what matters least that we miss what matters the most. If it were really important to know, then God could have communicated in language that was equally clear to everybody's satisfaction what these creatures are. So the point is not what the creature is, the point is what kind of creature these are. What kind of creature? What kinds of creatures these are? What kind of creatures are they? Well, in both cases, Behemoth and Leviathan, they're big, they're intimidating, and they are beyond man's ability to tame or to control. That's what they both have in common. And that's why God talks about them. In other words, what the creature is not and was is not nearly so important as why the Lord talks about it. So, let's look at Exhibit A, Behemoth. Verses 15 through 24 of chapter 40. The word Behemoth is just a Hebrew word for beast, and it's in the plural. It literally would be rendered beasts. Behold, beasts. But all the pronouns and the verbs referring to it are in the singular. So he's not just talking about animals in the plural. He's talking about a specific large creature that's called Behemoth. And we use Behemoth that way now to describe something that's just huge. Okay? And the suggestion is that the plural itself in Hebrew often signifies the bigness of something. So it's some creature of mammoth proportions. So what is the whole point of God's discussion of this animal? Well, God is going to tuck into his description of both Behemoth and Leviathan, he tucks into the description why he's talking about them. He tells you why. And you know the key verses in both of those exhibits because it's the point at which God shifts the attention from the animal to himself. So, chapter 40, verse 15. "Look now at Behemoth, which I made along with you." First point. Man, Job specifically here, but man is a co-creature with Behemoth. First thing God points is, look at Behemoth. I made him just like I made you. You are co-creatures together. I made both of you. And then God describes this animal with a sense of creative pride and artistic delight. The way he talks about this creature. See now, verse 16, "His strength is in his hips. His power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze. His ribs are like bars of iron." It's like God delights in describing how massive and powerful and almost unbreakable this creature is that he has made. It is a powerful, impressive marvel of biological engineering. And men, like Job, are scrawny weaklings by comparison, and yet they are co-creatures. Verse 19, here's the second time he turns attention away from the animal to himself. "He is the first of the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring near his sword." Another translation renders this, "He is the foremost of God's works. Only his maker can draw the sword against him." In other words, only the one who made him can control him. You're a co-creature. You're made in God's image, but you can't even stand up to this animal. It's just an animal, a co-creature. The second point then, the first point again is Job is a mere co-creature with this thing. The second is Job is no match even for one of God's animals. And who is he taking to court? God, the one who made that creature that he can't even stand up to. It gets even more explicit in the second exhibit, beginning in chapter 41, verse 1. When he basically asks, can you tame Leviathan? Behemoth only gets 10 verses. Leviathan gets 34 verses. And God brings his speech to this dramatic climax with this jaw-dropping creature. And again, what does this have to do with Job? And as with Behemoth, the theological significance is folded into God's description, and it's clear when God begins to shift the attention from the creature to himself. So begin reading in chapter 41, verse 1. Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook? Or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him like a bird? Will you leash him for your maidens to play with? Can you fill his skins with harpoons, verse 7, or his head with fishing spears? Leviathan is a terrifying creature. Coming face to face with this beast in the wild on your own is a knee-buckling experience. And any hope of entering into one-to-one combat and overcoming him is a joke. Now you might think, oh, wait a minute. I've heard this is something like an alligator. And some alligators, estuarine saltwater alligators, have known to grow to 30, 35 feet. I mean, today. This is not dinosaurs. It's today. You think, yeah, but we know that a whole bunch of people could gather up and gang up on this thing and stab it with spears. That's not the point. God's not talking about a whole bunch of people. He's talking about Job. And he's pitting Job himself because all of the pronouns through here are singular. This is not about what guys can do. This is about what one man, Job, can do. Can you do this to Leviathan? And he's pitting Job face to face, one on one, with another one of his fellow creatures. And Job is no match at all. In fact, he says, verse 9, lay your hand on him, remember the battle, you will never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false. Shall not one be overwhelmed just at the sight of him? So what's the point? Look at the next verse, chapter 41, verse 10. And again, we know this is the key point because God is shifting the attention from Leviathan to his point about himself. Verse 10, no one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? No man in his right mind would want to disturb or pick a fight with this creature. And it's just an animal. Who then thinks he can stand up to me? Do you realize who you're dealing with? You see the who question coming out again. But that's not all. Look at verse 11. Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven is mine. That word that's translated precede is translated, I think, prevent in the King James, can mean either to precede or to confront. So it's sometimes translated this way, who has first given anything to me that I should be obliged to repay him? Or it could be translated this way, who has confronted me, like with some debt? Who could confront me with some debt? Or who can claim that I owe them something? Everything under the whole heaven is mine. And God's declaration drives us full circle back to a truth that surfaces at the very beginning of the book. Job had done nothing to deserve losing everything he possessed. God acknowledges that in chapter 2, verse 3. Job had not done anything to deserve losing everything. But Job had done nothing to deserve anything he possessed in the first place. That's what God is reminding Job of here. Job has no claim to make on God. Because God owns everything and owes no man anything. Your house, your spouse, your possessions, your position, your ministry, your children, your health, your very life's breath that you are drawing right now doesn't belong to you. It is a gift from God. All of these are gifts from God that He has given to you graciously since the moment you came out of the womb naked with nothing. You've given God nothing that obligates Him to repay you anything that you presently possess. What He gives is gracious and without cause and may be removed without cause and without explanation. Because we don't worship Him for stuff, do we? That's the accusation that starts the whole thing from Satan. He worships you for stuff. Take the stuff away, he'll curse you to your face. Job proved that there are people in the earth who don't worship God for stuff. Are we among them? And we may not think that God owes us stuff, but we may think God owes us an explanation. And that's just as mistaken. What God says here, everything belongs to me, is true of everything. And look how God concludes his case, his speech, his whole answer to Job. Look how he concludes chapter 41, verses 33 and 34. On earth there's nothing like him who is made without fear. He beholds every high thing. He's still talking about Leviathan. He is king over all the children of pride. The idea of beholding is, it's just the word look, but the context can flavor what kind of looking you're talking about. And the idea here is that he disdains, he stares down the high and mighty. A king with robes and a sword on his side and all the power in the world. Okay, yeah, go on, go ahead. Meet Leviathan one-on-one, see how well you do. Just an animal. I don't care how big and powerful you are, you can't stand up against just an animal. He disdains and stares down the mighty. He is king over all the proud. In other words, he rules them. He cows even the proud ones. And he's just one of God's creatures. Period. Case closed. God's done. No final moral. No wrap up. No, okay, so Job, here's what you should have learned from this. He just finishes his description of Leviathan and he's done. God closes with words designed to humble humans who are inclined to file grievances against God. Job can't stand up just to one of God's beasts. How can he ever dream of challenging God and God's ways? Who is Job to critique God's ways and advise him on how he should run things, including his own life? This is the point God is making. Not very delicately, even. Pretty straightforwardly and boldly, but with this intertwining reminder that he is a gracious and a good and a compassionate and a very aware God. The excellent commentator Derek Kidner writes this about how God concludes this discourse. He says that a discourse which began with the cosmos, the world, the universe, and everything in it, that a discourse which began with the cosmos should end in praise of two aquatic monsters, however fearsome, may strike us as eccentric. And that it should ignore our burning questions altogether. Why? Job's question. That it should ignore our burning questions altogether may be a bitter disappointment, but there is no mistaking the thrust of it. It cuts us down to size, treating us not as philosophers, but as children, limited in mind, puny in body, whose first and fundamental grasp of truth must be to know the difference between our place and God's and to accept it. He says, if instead of this, we were offered a defense of our Creator's ways for our approval, if God took the pains to explain to Job, okay, Job, let me explain what's going on here. Here's what happened. If God did that instead, it would imply that he was accountable to us and not we to him. Some have complained that God's reply to Job in these chapters may be artistically beautiful and poetic, but so irrelevant as to border on absurd. You read commentators who will say that. What's really funny is it didn't strike Job that way. Job did not see this as absurd or irrelevant. Read his response in chapter 42, verses 1 through 6. The problem is not with the Lord's answer. Job gets it. The question is, do we? Let's pray. Lord, once more we pause in your presence, very consciously in your presence. We are always in your presence. We live and breathe and move and die in your presence. But we come consciously in your presence to thank you for the message of this book, to thank you for your wisdom and your power, your majesty, your glory, your beauty, your greatness. And your creation is just a small physical demonstration of the magnificent kind of God that you are. And you have, your word teaches us, shaped us in your own image. And when we fell and sinned against you, as we fall and sin against you every day, you voluntarily, unnecessarily, willingly sacrificed yourself to fix that. You are, Lord, above all, a gracious and a merciful and a compassionate and a loving God. But you are holy and righteous and just and pure. So remind us, Lord, that our burning question should not be why. Our burning question and focus should be who we are and who you are. And teach us, Lord, to always view our circumstances through the lens of what we know, because you have told us what you're like. We would learn to view our circumstances through the lens of what we know to be true of you. And help us, Father, to magnify you in that way. We pray in Jesus' name.